All right, let's assume that we are it. This will be a demonstration of the power of low turnout elections. I realized that I could, of course, have conducted this as an exercise in electronic democracy and taken a poll on the website, but of course you understand why I wouldn't do that. There should be some tiny little positive returns for coming to class, such as they may be. So the decision that we face is reducible to simplicity in the usual plebiscitary fashion. Shall we have a second essay and a second rewrite, or shall we have a series of technical exercises designed to at least introduce you, if not actually to instruct you in how to live a safer 21st century existence? In keeping with the general desire of law students always to minimize risk, let's look at the risks first. If you decide that what you want is a set of technical exercises, then those aren't gradable. They're really go or no go, success or I had trouble or can you help me kinds of propositions, which means that the grade will come to depend upon the first essay and its rewrite, which is less diversity of work and less chance for improvement, though you can still greatly improved that first essay, as you all know. They were excellent bad first drafts. So the risk is that your grade is based on a less diverse set of inputs. The benefit, of course, is the grade is based on less diverse inputs, and you don't have to worry about it from here on out. Just rewrite one thing. It's much simpler. The risk of technical exercises is you'll hate them. You won't be interested, you'll forget about them, it turned out I didn't teach you anything, which is eminently possible. Therefore you should decide what is of more value to you in the course. That's the basis of the vote, is it not? More writing, a second exercise of the same kind, but of a different sort, because you choose for yourself what you want to write about, or less writing, more figuring out what the hell Eben is talking about the ways we could do things differently if we wanted to. That's pretty much how I would set up the vote if I were writing the Board of Elections pamphlet. But there may be other questions. Questions? This is intended to be simple and quick. You understand, I don't want to spend an hour on this, but I'm happy to answer any questions. Yeah?
Even if the vote is for the exercise, and we've already started writing the second one?
Then I would certainly suppose that you should write the second one, because you've already started, and because at that point you could say to me, well, Eben, isn't two papers sufficient for a minor writing credit if everybody else did only one? So you'd probably find a way not to waste your time and effort. But I agree, nobody should ever do any extra learning around here if at all possible. So it's a strong point. Any other similar strong points?
I'm sorry, you said that for the minor writing credit, that would just be an extra.
Well, that would be you, wouldn't it? I mean, yeah, you would have in the end written two papers. I'm not going to let you get a writing credit for only one, but now instead of three, you have two, because they voted for exercises. In fact, you could be very senatorial about it and vote for two papers under the assumption that you'll be outvoted and everything will be fine, right?
I'll go with my colleagues.
No, I know you will. That's right. Deferring to the majority of the House. The good news, of course, is the majority of the House is going to listen to this on tape and they're not going to vote at all. Anything further? By show of hands, then, how many people prefer a second paper? Those who have already started writing them? Yes. And by show of hands, how many people prefer technical exercises? I'm surprised the number of abstentions is even one. Okay, good. So we have decided, and everybody else who didn't come to class, you have decided for them. So we will begin with an exercise in public key encryption, how to make a GPG or PGP key and put it on the key servers, how to correspond with people in a secure, encrypted fashion through email without having to share any secrets with them, how therefore to introduce to your friends and family and co-conspirators and others the ability to encrypt email and to strongly encrypt data files. So we'll begin with that exercise. The second exercise should be an exercise in proxy browsing, how to use any computer somewhere that multiple people use as a way of fulcruming your browsing so that you are harder to track, so that you appear to be in privileged locations in the net, etc. Columbia University having interfered with this, I'm going to decide whether it is feasible to use one of my own computers as the proxy for you so that at least you can figure out how to do it, which wouldn't be a good long-term solution because that computer will go away when the course ends and be replaced by another version of the same computer, and it won't work for you, but I will try that. At least I'll see if I can think of an engineering way which is suitably easy on all of us. The third exercise will be an exercise in how to achieve workable sort of anonymity using Tor and the Tails operating system, and will be the first exercise in which I'm going to try and work through for you how to escape your laptop's current operating system by booting a different operating system. In that exercise, Tails, to provide workable anonymity in the net. There'll be a third exercise, either a third or a fourth exercise thereafter, in how, again, to change what runs in your laptop, not to achieve anonymity, but to achieve plain vanilla unrecognizability. That is, how to use a computer that has never existed before, will not exist for another 10 minutes after you finish using it, so that whatever it does on the net will just look like it was done by some newbie who had just installed a computer. There's no history, there's nothing to trap, there's nothing to find, nobody who uses or attacks your computer can discover anything, and the minute you're done with it, it never exists again. Disposable computing, which is far more secure than well-protected computing is in other circumstances. So we'll try a series of those exercises. For each of those exercises after the first one, it would be desirable for your laptop to remain the same laptop physically all the way through, so you don't have to learn how to boot different operating systems on two different devices. The only exception will be if you happen to be using one of those Intel Mac boxes that actually doesn't want any foreign software outside Mac OS X to run on it, in which case we'll fall into period of uncertainty. Anybody who wishes to borrow from me a disposable Chromebook for the period of these exercises, so that not only are you using disposable software, but you're using borrowed hardware, that's fine. Come and see me in office hours, and I'll hand you a disposable laptop computer for which you are deeply responsible until you bring it back to me. If you bring it back to me in distorted shape, then you have to pay the full cost of the laptop, which is $80. Because, of course, you shouldn't use $1,000 laptops, should you? I mean, why would you? Oh, because they look so cool, I know. But, of course, part of what I'm suggesting is that that's part of what's wrong with our relationship to computers and part of how we get scalped by the platforms and the spies and the telecommunications intermediaries. We are treating our computers as jewelry. And that's really not a good way to treat computers, but it feels so cool that we keep doing it. Very convenient. All right, so that's basically the program. There will be 3 to 4 exercises over the next couple of weeks. My job is to be technical support and to actually make it possible for you to complete these forms of work. Your job, after you have learned how to do these things, is to teach them to at least one other person. Right? That's the functional deal. No more questions or objections? All right, well then let's get to the continuation of where we were last week for a little while longer. Now, evidently for a lot longer because of the exercises, but I won't necessarily only be talking about tech here after today. Last time we were together, I was trying to present a case about the federation of services, about why it is that in the threats to privacy and secrecy, anonymity and security that human beings currently experience in the net, it is largely as a consequence of the over-centralization of services that they are so vulnerable. that we have taken technical architecture like email or cloud storage or calendaring or forms of messaging that are lighter weight than email, and we have treated them as services which should be organized with one big server. Etc., etc., each of which connects everybody who uses the service, or at least is ambitious to connect everybody who uses the service. The asserted value is the service is free, that it is offered at price zero, in return for the extortionate actual price, which is the collection of the behavior of everybody using the service. Both the primary collection, which is access to the content of what is being shared, at least here and here, if not there, and secondarily, because all of the metadata, which is both the metadata actually surrounding the message, where it came from, what time, what date, to whom sent, etc., and the larger context of metadata, what your heart rate was when you used the server, what your location was when you used the service, what your state of mind was when you used the service, all of which, of course, is captured. Of course. You do know that the camera facing you, the one that has to exist if the thing can be called an Android device, for example. Google's trademark policy with respect to Android is nothing can be called an Android anything unless it has a camera facing the user. That makes it hard, for example, to build an Android car unless you have a camera facing the driver, because you can't call a thing Android that doesn't have a camera facing the user. It's very convenient. You do understand that that camera facing you can take your pulse. The beating of your heart and the movement of blood through the blood vessels behind your face causes, mostly in us pink people, you understand, but not only in pink people, measurable changes in the color of the face. And those are regular and periodic, and they amount to the pulse. So the heart rate of the user of the device can be established by the you-facing camera without further instrumentation. Oh, but of course you did have a Fitbit, right? So we should just understand that the context of data collection in the centralized service, if it is going through the spy satellite in your pocket, is richer than just who you were communicating with at the time. It's your recent physical and mental activity as it is captured by software. And the software is supported by a very dense collection of sensors whose purpose is to sense you. Right? Inertia monitoring to determine your movement and speed of movement, how fast you get up from your chair, and all of those things. What we call small data. The data established by the device closest to you. For the benefit of the parties who collect that information in return for a commodity service which instead of being federated has been centralized. So the bulk of what I had to say last week concerns the possibility that we don't do it that way. That instead of centralizing services, we federate them. That is to say, we disperse the provision of the service as widely as possible, amounting in the end, if possible, to the dispersal of the service provision as widely as the service is consumed. There are an infinite number of configurations of federated services. In theory, everybody can run an email server, and provide an email box to everybody else. There is no limit to the extent to which we can break up email. The success of Google in putting everybody's email behind one chain link fence is enormously beneficial to Google, but not beneficial to anybody else. And, of course, because any paired service, any service which connects human beings at the endpoints, is subject to coercion. See, if I run an email server and take very good care of how my email moves around in the world and where it gets deposited when it stops moving, which I do, and if 57% of the people to whom I send email or who send email to me are at Gmail, which they are, then 50% of my email escapes every bit of my effort to control it, no matter what I do, save strong encryption, because it's all going to wind up behind Google's chain link fence anyway. If one person in my family uses Gmail and one person in my family still uses Yahoo from the Stone Age, then Yahoo and Google will get automatically copies of all the email circulated in my family, whether I am allowing that or not in some broad general sense. I have not agreed to anybody's terms of service. I've simply sent email. The same will, of course, be true about shared calendar. I was serving on the advisory committee of some wonderful electronic privacy kind of organization that I deeply believe in and donate money to every year once. And like most advisory committees, its real purpose is that the management of the nonprofit puts people on the advisory committee so it never needs to take their advice under any circumstances. And so there's a mailing list in which we all vaporize and bloviate and behave strongly, and therefore nobody ever has to listen to anything we say. And one morning on that list, which consists of knowledgeable people who are specialized in this area in one way or another, one of my distinguished colleagues on the advisory committee mailing list was complaining. His problem was that he was creeped out, unusually, because his daughter had written email to him to say when she was coming home from college and on which flight. And Google had quite helpfully and conveniently taken the content of that email and put it on his calendar for him to remind him when his daughter was coming home from college, on which flight and which terminal in the airport she was going to be at which time. And this creeped him out. Experienced and knowledgeable as he was. And so he's complaining on the advisory committee mailing list about, you know, how creepy this is that Google is calendaring his family's movements on the basis of the email they have read. And I thought, well, I always repurpose the caps lock key on the keyboard, of course, as you would if you controlled your own keyboards, because why would you still have a caps lock? But this was one of the moments when I was missing it. Because I thought to myself, I should just hit the caps lock key and say, why are you still using Google then? But I refrained because I don't have a caps lock key and what's the point? But the question is still right. If he's creeped out, why is he still using the service? And the answer is, of course, because he can't imagine not using the service. Because the very idea of federating away from those services, even though he is both a knowledgeable specialist and a technically capable human being, still doesn't fully register with him. If you don't want this happening, don't let it happen. If we were going to say that in a broader technical sense, we would say, don't let it happen. We don't have to do it. Why should we do it? Federation is, in that sense, simply a defense mechanism. Spreading technological knowledge and technological capability through society makes it stronger. Centralizing knowledge and technical capability makes society weaker. It's not complicated, but it's highly desirable for centralizers of services to keep us from seeing it. And what they hope is every once in a while when we get creeped out by the fact that over-centralized services are really socially dangerous to us, we'll dissociate that idea away, we'll forget about it, we'll pretend we didn't see it, we'll think, oh, but that would be too much trouble, And in one or another way, there will be friction that will keep us from reallocating the infrastructure so that the services we use are supplied by people we can trust in decentralized environments in which, if they don't turn out to be trustworthy, they don't have that much of our data and it's not that big a deal. It is also, of course, true that any centralized service is capable of being penetrated more easily than a highly federated service. If the Chinese Ministry of State Security wants to listen to everything going on in American university classrooms during the epidemic, Zoom is the only place you have to attack. Well, except for those outriders who know that video conferencing is a completely federatable service. There's no actual reason why we should all be using a centralized video conferencing system. So if during that period the Chinese Ministry of State Security had wanted access to what was going on in my classroom, they'd have to go and break into my servers. Well, let's suppose that my servers are less well protected than Zoom, although that would be untrue. Still, knocking me down gets them one set of classes. It's the scale upon which attacking centralized services is valuable that makes them desirable to attack, no matter how well protected they are. You scoop to everything. Not the little thing, not the one person, not the 12 people's mail, not one family, not one co-conspirator cell, not one branch of the forbidden political party, but everything. Therefore, of course, the returns to attacking go up drastically. Therefore, the quantity of attacking goes up drastically. And to the extent that the services begin trying to resist attackers, well, the attackers go to the endpoints and they develop software for hitting the smart ass phones. Because anything that strengthens this weakens that, so let's go after that. And the next thing you know, you suddenly have an international arms industry for breaking into smart ass phones. Once that has developed, you want to decentralize technical design. It used to be that the fools at the FBI thought, oh, we can have perfect cybersecurity. We'll just buy computers from the king of the undead, now dead, because they're perfect. And the Bureau simply fell headfirst into the cesspool of believing in Apple hardware. It's perfect, but it isn't perfect, of course. Indeed, it's grossly imperfect for a centralization reason. Attacking every Android smart-ass phone on Earth requires you to have a lot of different exploits against a lot of different versions of every smart-ass phone on Earth. It's actually a little trickier because there's a little more inherent diversity. Want to attack iPhones? Yeah, there may be fewer vulnerabilities in iOS compared to all the Android versions with all the Android vulnerabilities that have ever existed. But screw one, you screw them all. And the monoculture, once again, operates in order to reduce individual security and individual privacy for convenience. We therefore want to decide how to understand convenience in relation to people's actual needs. And that's hard, but not for technical reasons. It's hard for other reasons that we'll come back to. So the point of last week's investigation is to establish that intermediate point. The service federation is an architectural answer to a lot of problems. If you architect in ways which increase people's power individually and collectively in small groups to replace the platform services with individuated services, everybody's security goes up, everybody's privacy goes up, and the business model of I will give you commodity services in ways that are beneficial to me and may be beneficial to attackers but are not distinctively beneficial to you goes down. All right, on the basis of that summary, questions, inquiries, objections. I want to build on this, so I want to be sure that everybody is comfortable with it, whether they agree or disagree or whatever now. Have I been at least coherently intelligible to you in explaining the difference between federated and centralized services and why we should care? Okay. So let us then ask, what does it take to make the next step and wonder whether government should have a policy in favor of centralization or federation of services? And maybe even, is there a constitutional element of this? So the first step in that process is to say, what would it mean for government to have a generally developed policy with respect to the architecture of computing and telecommunications in its society in favor of federation? Well, one thing that would be required if a government actually wished to make the architecture of IT in society its abiding interest, we wish to reform the services market so that services are less centralized and therefore the economics of services is less concentrated, so that the deal, I will give you, quote, free, close quote, services in return for all your human behavior, is not really an uncompeted with point of view, that there is architecture competition in society and not merely service provision competition in society. What would that require of government? First of all, it would require that telecommunications operators not be able unilaterally to decide for themselves to prevent federation. Let's leave aside the university network for a moment. Let's put you back on the street as complete civilians in America. You go down to the store on the corner, where there is a store on every corner from a telecommunications intermediary, and you ask to buy whatever it is that individual human beings can buy in that store on that corner. They will, of course, immediately move you to the smart-ass phone, which they'll give you an excellent price on, or even free, or whatever it is. And they'll move you to capped networking, in which, past a certain point, you pay for data at levels that are just, I mean, entirely unrelated to value. Pure monopoly pricing, and they'll offer you networking contract parameters, which basically put you out of the federating services business, right? Why? Because the consumer bandwidth contract that you enter into, whether it is wired networking or it is wireless networking, will prohibit you from running any servers. What does that actually mean? We go back to the architecture of the net. A service is simply a directionality. This smart-ass phone here made a request to this server over here, and the server transmitted data back. That might have been you typed a URL into the location bar of a browser, in which case the smart-ass phone went to port 80 or port 443 on this server, and there submitted a request that says, here's a URL, give me the page. Or it might have been that the smart-ass phone says, do I have any email? Which might be occurring once again on either a standard port or a standard encrypted port. And the server at the other end says, I have some email for you, here are the headers, do you want the content of those messages? That assumes that the email protocol is IMAP. Never mind for a moment what all that means. Or it might be a calendar request by CalDAV. Will you please put this on my calendar, Mr. Server? Yes, okay. Do you want to see next week now? All of those are simply paired interactions. What we call a service is one computer being asked a question and giving an answer. But contractually, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint, whatever it is, will say, well, you're allowed to do it this way, but you can never do it that way. You can't ever be a server. You can't get questions and answer them. You can only ask questions and receive answers, because that's the contract that we made with you. Oh, you'd like to be a server? You want to actually put web pages back in people's hands? You want to deliver email and store it for people instead of just asking some centralized email service? Oh, in that case, please come back to us and buy a business contract. for an order of magnitude more. Consumer networking from the wireless companies in the United States is extraordinarily expensive. I mean, just horrendously expensive. But that's mostly because of data caps and data limits. The business contract is exorbitantly expensive too, but that's the privilege of being a server that you are buying. The privilege of being fully in the network, not half in, half out, not an amputated body, but one with all its limbs. And for that, we sell you a high price. None of that is necessary to the operation of the network. It's totally trivial. That makes no difference whether from the TCP/IP point of view, from the TCP point of view, the request moved in this direction or this one. Nothing changes about that. It's simply a consequence of an architect chosen by private parties with the assistance and endorsement of government. If government wished to make architectures for privacy, security, and freedom its business, if it meant to organize its policy around that, it would just say, well, this is not allowed. You can't do that. You can't discriminate on the basis of which direction the request was made or to which port on which computer. The condition we're talking about is ordinarily described in this foolish phrase, network neutrality. What makes the phrase foolish is that no network can be operated actually in a neutral fashion. That's not a technical reality. Why? Well, because timing is crucial in the provision of services. I don't mean email. If you say to Gmail, could you show me the headers of my unread mail, it will not matter to you. It will not matter to you whether it takes 110 milliseconds or 550 milliseconds before you get an answer. At 500 milliseconds, half a second, you might complain, oh, the performance is terrible at Gmail today. Or maybe you wouldn't start to complain until it became 6 seconds. But you're not really sensitive to quality of service, which is the technical term for how rapidly those packets move. But that will never be true when it's a question of a voice call. Past about 300 milliseconds of packet delay, human beings stop recognizing speech as coherent. You get the phenomenon that human beings call breaking up. The minute that the flow of human speech begins to exceed the time or degrade past the reliability level at which we experience human speech naturally, we mentally become intolerant. I don't need to explain that this is more true of speech than it is true of vision. Because you all know that a thing that produces crappy frozen face video in a video call will be tolerable in a way that incoherence in the speech passing back and forth is not tolerable. This is built into the wiring. And it's built into the wiring for a funny reason. You might imagine, of course, that a human brain, like any other instrument of information processing, takes longer to do some jobs than other jobs. And it's true. The sound analysis elements of the human neurology are faster than the vision processing, because vision is complicated, comparatively speaking. Not, as we'll discover, to software, but to the human brain. In fact, there's an actual problem in synchronization between your recognition of sound and your recognition of visual material. And it's a fixed element in each human being. It approximates 11 milliseconds. In other words, in order to get a synchronous view of the world, in order to get a view of the world in which what you're hearing corresponds to what you're seeing, so that the lip movements of people are absolutely correlated with the syllabic content of their speaking, the human brain actually needs to slow down audio transmission, waiting for the video to catch up. It's a really tricky thing that we just know how to do. But we know how to perform internally the different timescales of speech recognition and video recognition, so that when we look at people in the world and their lips move, we hear their speech coherently as against our picture of their lips moving. It's a great, sophisticated outcome. And it's pretty easy to make not work in the digital world. So the minute speech begins to break up, the brain gets very unhappy with the timing. It isn't able to coordinate speech to vision, and the preference is for coherent speech, because that's the one where the timing delay has to be added. Vision processing occurs as fast as it can. The consequence of which is that we get very neurologically intolerant of the disruption of coherent speech. Therefore, every network all the time has to be aware in its management of what it's moving. The demands are not as strict as information theory would suggest. In 1947, Claude Shannon, one of the founders of information theory and one of the basic builders of Bell Labs as a superb research institution, Claude Shannon wrote a brilliant paper, which I grew up on, explaining why packet switching would never work in a telephone system. We go back to my original explanation of this long ago about circuit switching, right? Telephone systems in the 20th century switched by circuitry. That is, when you made a phone call to another number, for a period of time, a single loop, which probably included only copper wires in your small town, but certainly included long-distance microwave if you were making a long-distance call, a circuit, a pathway for the exchange of information flows came into existence for the time of the call and was destroyed again when the call was over. Some of you may remember Stone Age European telephone pricing, which consisted of impulse ticks, right? How long a call lasted was how much it cost. The Americans moved to flat-rate local calls in the 1960s. European state-owned telecommunication services never did, because it made more money the other way. The call was costed by its length. And that was justifiable in a world of circuit switching, because for the period of the call, some machinery was dedicated. Stepper bar exchanges in the old world, or just exchange capacity to create a single circuit. The alternative was always known to be packet switching, which is how the internet as a whole currently works. Every transmission is broken up into tiny little segments. Tiny in this sense, because IP packets subjected to the internet protocol, are all 64 bytes wide, with some header material. It's a tiny amount of stuff. 40 characters is the payload, let's say. And you break up a telephone call, which is on the order of several hundred kilobytes a second, into tiny little packets of 64 bits, and you send them out into the world, and some are going to arrive sooner than others, and you can't be sure that they're all going to take the same pathway through the network. So Shannon wrote a beautiful paper in 1947 proving that you could never use packet switching to contain telephone calls, because packet density and failure of transmission and out-of-order arrival would all make it impossible for human speech to be heard in a coherent way. As I say, it was an absolutely brilliant paper, and I grew up thinking of it as a great work in the foundations of information theory, and it was totally fucking wrong. But we didn't know that until we started using packet switching for telephone calls, and it turned out that we could get things inside the actual limits of human tolerance of disrupted speech. This is why you now have what in my childhood would have been regarded as just horrible telephone conversation quality. Your phone calls are always bad. But not so bad that you can't understand what's going on. And so it's very convenient to use packet switching, as indeed it is. Nobody would think of going back to circuit switch structures in the network nowadays, but that's because we know that we can do enough network management that we can provide adequate quality of service for audio calls, which means we cannot possibly use the network in a neutral way. We can't really treat all packets as the same. But we can do two other things. We can prohibit discriminatory routing. Right? We can say to the guy in the middle, you're not allowed to manipulate the rules in order to support yourself. Yes, you have to do whatever you have to do in order to make your network work, which means you're certainly not going to be able to treat everything as the same. You're going to have to know what's video signals, what's audio signals. You're going to have to do your best to make things work so that if a guy has to spend 10 milliseconds more getting his email headers, he's not going to be bothered. But if you begin to pass the 330 millisecond line in the way you treat voice calls, everybody's going to hate you and they're all going to refuse to pay their bill. You just can't discriminate among the things that are the same because they're different to your business interests. Right? And we can obey the rules of common carriage, which is broader than this, but of a slightly different legal kind. Anti-discriminatory routing practices are about competition law or antitrust. And they descend from the treatment of the railroads. Discriminatory routing practices or discriminatory pricing practices are what made state and local governments furious at the railroads in the 19th century and led towards the Sherman Act. This is why there's a constitutional issue about the interstate commerce power in 1881 in Wabash against Illinois over whether the United States government can make rules that determine the rates at which railroads haul intrastate freight. The goal of the local government is to prevent discrimination in railroad pricing within Illinois and against Illinois. And the question is, does the federal power to control commerce allow them to attack discriminatory rate practices by railroads inside the states? So the questions of discriminatory routing in telecoms, are you really allowed to forbid journeys in one direction and only allow journeys in the other direction, is essentially a competition law. And it's a problem which analogizes, or fails to analogize, the problem of 21st century telecommunications to the problem of 19th century railroading, with which it has indeed quite a close connection. The rules of common carriage are older and deeper in the history of the common law. And they don't just involve the wagon itself. The common law is traditional, that is, from early modern European growth. The common law's tradition among the English-speaking people is to treat all sorts of infrastructure of travel as subject to a rule of non-discrimination among persons. Right? If you're an innkeeper, you have to take who shows up. If you're a wagon carting packages, the only thing you're allowed to determine is how much does it weigh and how far is it going. And in particular, you can't look inside the package. This is the so-called carrier's case, one of those fundamental pieces of 15th century criminal law, remember? The question was, when is the party who ships packages through wagons a thief? And the answer is when he broke bulk, when he opened the package and looked inside. That was when it became larceny. Yeah, the person who shipped it voluntarily delivered the package to him. Under the common law of theft, that means that because it was voluntarily given to him, he didn't steal it if he took it somewhere it didn't belong. that's pair, right? The guy who rents the horse and takes it in the other direction. I mean, you remember all of this. Your crimes course spent 27 seconds on it. But the rule is, the moment the carrier broke bulk, the moment he opened the package, he had stolen. Even if he took nothing from the package, because that exceeded what he was given, which was simply the right to carry the package from here to there. These rules, which are tort and crime rules, rules of responsibility for wrong, are the rules which underlie the medieval English economy's understanding of how people and things get from place to place. It's not, of course, the only way that we can think about things like duties of hospitality. In the eastern woodlands, or in fact the whole eastern half of North America before Europeans arrived, it was entirely possible for a human being to walk from Massachusetts to Louisiana through collections of people with whom that traveler had no common language, not even a common language family. Different tribes, different systems of property and marriage and et cetera, but across the whole of that part of North America, the clans of the eagle and the wolf are existing everywhere, and wherever you go, there are people who have a responsibility to provide you with hospitality and food because they're of your clan. Of course, that means all those people of your clan are brothers and sisters, and you can't marry them or have sex with them while you're traveling, because that would be incest. But you have a hospitality right, and therefore a travel right. Indigenous observers of Europeans, when they finally showed up around here, didn't understand why Europeans didn't get it. Why did they charge for things like that? How could they possibly refuse food and hospitality to travelers? But of course, they're not part of the clan system. They're foreigners. In this sense, then, you could say that the rules of common carriage are simply cultural specifics. They're not in some deep way connected to the laws of nature or justice, but they are part of our legal heritage. And they're available as rules, right? It's a system that we understand. You can't discriminate on the basis of who is shipping what. You can't look inside it to find out what it is. You can price it according to the costs of moving it, but you can't otherwise interfere with the commonness of your responsibility. So if you add discriminatory, non-discriminatory routing requirements to the rules of common carriage, you get what network neutrality is supposed to do, except that, of course, there's no such literal thing as a neutrally operated network. It would fall apart. So we can imagine, then, that a government which wants to exercise its power over the architecture of communications in society, and what government doesn't want to do that, and which wants to do it in a way which supports privacy and secrecy and human freedom, will begin by saying our telecommunications regulations will impose duties of non-discriminatory routing and make common carriers out of the carriers. This is essentially now the Democratic position in the United States with respect to the FCC. That's what Tom Wheeler's second Obama term attitudes effectively committed the Democratic Party to. If we are in power and if we have the right to use all the powers of the FCC, we will make the telecommunications operators common carriers. Or, if not, we will make them opt out. They're not common carriers. They're going to provide over-the-top services. They're going to compete with people. But under those circumstances, they're going to have to accept comprehensive regulation. This essentially replaced what was the neoliberal consensus between the Democratic and Republican parties over the previous 20 years, which from Bill Clinton's telecommunications liberalization in 1996, basically, as I said here before, took the view that Americans will not tolerate monopoly, but they are intensely relaxed about duopolies. We will create a bunch of duopolies in American communications life, and then we will say you don't need to worry about oligopolies, folks, because all those oligopolies are going to drift into civil war with one another through service convergence, and it's all going to be just fine. Which was not true, and which at least half of the governance system of the United States has realized will not work. But that leaves the other half, which, if it has 40 votes in the United States Senate, is sufficient to veto any permanent effort to rewrite the law in the direction of non-discrimination and common carriage. That means, I suppose, that we can assume that well into the 2030s, whatever else happens, the United States will not be attempting to create a telecommunication system which favors service federation and all of the benefits that flow from it. But that's the first thing that a government committed to an affirmative policy of supporting technological and social freedom would do. The second thing that such a government would do would be directly to regulate behavior collection. Right? We have a whole series of regulatory structures which are about, well, health insurance privacy, banking privacy, video rental privacy. You know, the United States has a separate statutory structure for regulating privacy with respect to the rental of video cassettes. You do know this, right? No. Well, of course, because there's no Blockbuster Video on every corner anymore. Renting video cassettes? Really, really, really? Why would they have had a special law just about the rental of video cassettes, a business which existed for 2 hours once? Yes?
Is it a result of the court hearing?
Yes, it's the result of a Supreme Court confirmation fight. Exactly. Robert Bork, that great Catholic, cultural conservative, and superb legal intellectual, had rented a bunch of porn from Blockbuster Video in Washington, D.C. When nominated to the Supreme Court, this was a potential killer. Everybody got nervous about it. The Judiciary Committee had to suppress any conversation about Robert Bork's porn habits. The result of which was the Video Rental Privacy Act. Exactly correct. There are many things one could say about this with respect to Supreme Court confirmation hearings, with respect to the retributive and absolutely disgusting behavior, but mostly it's about the way privacy law is made, right? Privacy law is made on the basis of a background indifference and unconcern, modified only by the tribulations of the great. But of course, what we really need now is not columns of privacy, not health over here and banking over there. It's true that the specific fields in which human behavior is collected are different and they raise different problems, and they might in some instances require peripheral additional legislation of one kind or another, but it is now apparent to us, or rather it should be apparent to us, it is apparent to me and you anyway, that what we actually need is to begin at the root of the thing as it has developed and to say we need rules about the collection of human behavior in interstate commerce. If we start from that, then we will rapidly discover that that legislation, whether it directly intends to or not, will turn out to be favorable to federated services. Because federated services don't have to be financed by behavior collection. You sure you don't want that email account at kgbmail.net? Remember that I will read your mail forever and I will give you $100 and you won't have to pay for it. But maybe all you want to say is, Evan, why does kgbmail.net not offer me another deal in which you don't read my mail and you charge me for it? KGBmail.net doesn't care. I can do whatever I want. It's my server. You want to do it that way? We'll do it that way. What would it actually cost me? I mean, it's a scalable question. After the first 100,000 customers, I could make it cheaper. But what is it actually going to cost me to offer you an email box? not really mattering how much mail you receive or how big it is, I can still offer it to you for the pittance. $5 a month would more than cover my costs. Yet, no calculation of the worth of the behavior being collected from you by Gmail would suggest that it's worth only $5 a month. Behavior collection, in other words, is actually a form of taxation, and it's pretty severe. It represents a coercive pricing structure which says, you don't know what your behavior is worth, but we know. So we'll take it all, and we'll tell you that you're magnificently remunerated for giving us all your behavior, because we gave you email and calendaring and a few other stinky little services in return for it. Generally speaking, this is the sort of thing which legislators like to deal with. You mean there's a way that we could stop people from privately appropriating large parts of voters' wealth and return to them usefully valued, that they would see, oh my God, government worked for me? You would think that legislators would like that, but they don't like it because the pricing is still concealed. So the voter doesn't know how much has been done for her. And politics, not government, but politics really, 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 really loves behavior collection. Government loves behavior collection too if it wants to control people's behavior, which is why autocratic political systems will be never, 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 never interested in federated services. They will only want centralized services. But in what we are quaintly referring to as free societies, that is, ones with constitutional rights that an independent system of the rule of law will vindicate, that bias on government's part, we love spying on everybody, will not be validated. And the question will be, is government understood to be performing a work of value when it regulates behavior collection and discourages centralization of services and storage? Once again, we have no reason to believe that the United States government is going to adopt a system of behavior collection regulation anytime this decade, maybe not even next decade. But you can see why ultimately there is a ground for social and political realignment in that direction, because people are increasingly aware of the harm being done by pervasive data collection on people's individual behavior, and even though they're not willing to give up the smart-ass phone, the spy satellite in their pocket, and even though they're not willing, or at least they think they're not willing, to use different technologies in their own lives, there is, as our conversation in this room showed this semester, a great thirst for regulatory solutions, and a great illusory belief that this is European policy. Regulatory solutions, not actually occurring, but promised any day now, real soon. Because there is an understanding that there is an enormous political benefit to be gained. People actually do want government to take a stab at regulating, but there is not a clear identification of what it is that needs to be regulated or how such regulation would be constructed, because no actual government on earth has so far desired, or effectively desired, to explore that element of the story. So imagine an actual 21st century constitutional and civil liberties privacy-oriented government. Imagine that if you can. And then imagine what it will, as a matter of social engineering, what it will do in a legislative fashion to regulate behavior collection. And of course, I mean, the basic answer is fair pricing. The neoliberal view of it will be that the information being collected is the property of the citizen and it should be fairly paid for, which I actually think is not a good way of proceeding. And a more communitarian approach will be to say behavior collection threatens social peace and trust and our ability to work together as individuals for a better society and a more tranquil life. And therefore, we need to regulate behavior collection the same way that we would regulate toxic waste disposal or, you know, melamine in the baby formula or food safety regulation of any general kind. It's a collective action problem. People will sell their behavior too easily, and businesses will buy their behavior too cheaply, and there will be too much behavior data in society overall. We need to reduce the total output of behavior collection. Questions?
What's the issue with the, you said the neoliberal view is viewing as property of those individuals as bad. Is that, what are the sort of flaws for that?
Well, the primary problem is one of time. Judge Bork had no idea that his video rental receipts were going to stand between him and the intellectual feast of life on the Supreme Court, right? If it's property and it's transacted for as property, then sales are irreversible and valuation is arbitrary because the appearance of that data at any given moment is whatever it appears to be today. Once upon a time, I was on top of some glass box on 6th Avenue in an early winter evening, performing as a performing animal for Columbia Law School on a panel about privacy. This was a long time ago. I know it was a long time ago because I ain't no performing dog, and I haven't been for the longest time, but back then I still was. So I'm sitting in this glass box on 6th Avenue in the evening with a bunch of Columbia alum lawyers around discussing privacy. The three of us on the panel were supposed to be me and Moselle Thompson. You can see how long ago it was. Moselle was already a Federal Trade Commissioner. And a lawyer for privacy invaders from one of the firms across on Park Avenue who had to walk all the way to 6th Avenue to show up. And Moselle's plane was stopped because it was winter weather, and so it was just me and the privacy invader. And we're sitting there conducting our conversation. And about 20 minutes in, a Columbia Law School alumna who is not on the guest list and who is one of the most famous and most privacy-invaded human beings on Earth, those two are related to one another, walked in and sat down in the back row of the crowded room where nobody would be conscious of her arrival. And just at the moment that this person, who was a student of mine once upon a time, walked in, a lawyer is asking me a question. He's a New York County Lawyers Association kind of a guy, a downtown guy, not a downtown guy. And he wants to know what you just wanted, which is, why shouldn't we just turn all this into property and everything will work? And I say, well, look, here's the problem. Sometimes people's lives thrust them into the limelight in a way that they could never have foreseen. And everything they do and everything they've ever done becomes a matter of such overwhelming value to the press and other parties in society that they will never, ever, ever be able to live an ordinary life again. But they sold it. It's gone. It's not theirs anymore. Because it was their property and they transacted for it. And now, no matter what happens, they will never get it back. And as I'm saying this, I look at the back of the room and this person is looking me in the and I can feel her saying to me with all the force of her mind, Evan, if you mention my name at this moment, I am going to send cruise missiles after you. But of course, I had no intention of invading her privacy, so I didn't give her as the world's, one of the world's most evident examples of that problem. And And I finished my answer, and somebody else asked the privacy invader sitting next to me, who happened to share her surname but not related to her, a question. And when I looked back up, she was gone, vanished, out of the room, gone. That's the problem, or at any rate, that's the easiest of all problems. Imagine being her. You're 5 years old, and your father, the president of the United States, is assassinated. Right? That was Caroline at that moment. It won't work. It's a little bit like saying we're going to issue you a bunch of arbitrary coupons and you can transact for them at any time you want, but you'll never know whether they were really worth saving at the cost of your life before you let them go. Just that alone is a sufficient reason, from my point of view, to doubt the effectiveness, never mind the ideology, the effectiveness of propertization as a mechanism. It's just another form of misvaluation by compulsion. More about this? Anything else? Yeah.
I see, following up on what you just have discussed, I see that if we were to turn this into property,
then we'd have to invent the right to be forgotten, and we would start wondering whether somebody could disclose whether a Spanish dentist went bankrupt 12 years ago. Right? That's the other side of that, isn't it? That's what motivated that whole EU brain fart, was the effort to control the fact that the value of information to persons changes over time. And suddenly you have to go to war with freedom of information all over the rest of the world in order to try and get the toothpaste back in the tube. I'm sorry that I interrupted you, please.
What I'm thinking is that it could happen that certain groups, particularly those economically disadvantaged, could maybe accept a bad deal, right?
Because they need more money.
Right, and they could, that could turn them into target.
Well, I mean, obviously, with any system of property, the rich will do better than the poor. We don't have to get very low to the ground or carefully analytic to discover that property generally favors those who have it over those who don't. And that commodities markets that depend upon people's ability to pay or people's ability to refuse to be bought are more favorable to those who have more money than those who have less. On the other hand, it is also true that society's marginal groups may be a little bit more attentive to their privacy than other people. They may be less willing to transact. And that has also bad consequences if, for example, it makes them less likely to contribute to the public health by getting vaccinated, or contribute to the public safety by maintaining good relations with police, or beneficial outcomes because it keeps them from being easily absorbed into the maw of people who give away too much too easily. The only people who don't swipe off the tram are the people who did not pay to get on. Sitting on a tram in Holland, aware of the fact that everybody around me can be located within 6 seconds, please remember to swipe off the tram, I often think to myself that the only people on this tram who really care about that are me and the fare beaters. But you're right, that's another part of the problem of propertization, of course. Distributional injustice comes with propertization. If what I really want to do is make everybody equal, then I shouldn't make their behavior worth what somebody will pay for. We have passed, you understand, the point at which the behavior of the poor is worth collecting. That's what the onset of free basics by Facebook and other kinds of zero-rating networking around the world showed us at the beginning of last decade. It has become much more valuable to collect the behavior of the poor than it costs to put them on the network. And so the privacy invaders, the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, began wanting to get the other half of humanity on the net. You might have said they were the poor, but they still were valuable to collective behavior. And so what actually happened was that a kind of capitalist egalitarianism developed about this after 2010, as Facebook and Google and the other people started saying, I have balloons, I have satellites, I will put everybody on the net. Yeah, you will, but only if you can listen to everything they do. More about this? Well, those who wanted to write about smartphone penetration numbers in human society, here you are. Right? Notwithstanding the extraordinary expensiveness of manufacturing personal spy satellites to go in your pocket, it is now considered by Google, for example, to be highly effective to produce an operating system for the spy satellite in your pocket in the hope of reducing the cost so that everybody on Earth will carry one and the search box will be Google everywhere. We will know about everybody's wishes and concerns. And if we had to pay for that by putting hardware in the world or providing bandwidth, well, it would be cheap because behavior is so expensive and because people give it away so ignorantly and comprehensively. More here? All right. So a government that actually wanted affirmatively to structure the infrastructure of IT in its society so as to support the desires of its citizens for privacy, secrecy, restoration of autonomy would be in the behavior collection regulation business. Now, the United States is a poor model for the next point because, of course, it's the only society of wealth and power which doesn't centralize the service of educating its young. I can't say in the United States, if it cared about pro-privacy information policy, education would X, because we don't centralize education. So every school district across the continent will still be doing whatever the hell it wants. But you can certainly understand why any government which wishes affirmatively to exercise its powers in the direction of better privacy and security for its citizens will begin changing what is taught in schools. And even in the highly decentralized form of public education, which the United States prefers, that's historically well modeled. Post-Sputnik. The desire of the Americans to improve science education in this unmanageably incoherent public education continent of theirs was in the later 1950s absolutely apparent. And of course, we began using national defense against the Soviet Union to increase the science teaching in our schools the same way we built the interstate highway system. Social progress on the basis of its valuing beating godless communism, which, as you see, we did. It was replaced by non-communist, pro-God authoritarianism presently rocketing citizens of Ukraine. But we did improve science education in the United States for almost a whole generation. So what would it look like? Well, of course, as you know, we teach computer literacy in the United States, which means which drop-down menu to click on and which. What we don't teach is any of what I'm trying to teach you. And I admit that I would feel better about it if instead of offering my technical exercises in a law school classroom, I were offering them in seventh grade. In my view, the ideal parties in the Freedom Box Project are eighth grade science teachers. Every time an eighth grade science teacher turns up on the Freedom Box mailing list, I think, thank heavens for one more. Because what we actually need to do is teach young people enough about how computers work that they can run their own, that they can federate services, that all of that seems to them as easy as can be. back in that Robert Bork-inflected age when we had VHS cassettes, you may remember, no, you can't remember, but you can see in the movies that there were two classes of American households, one in which the clock on the VHS cassette player blinked zero, and the ones in which there was a 12-year-old. Because 12-year-olds knew how to set the clock on the VCR. And if you wanted to record your favorite shows and you didn't have a 12-year-old in the house, then you went to borrow a 12-year-old because adults didn't know how to set the clock on the VCR. If we actually wanted to change the technical infrastructure of society, it's young people about to become adults, acquiring an identity whom we want to teach things to. I remember this. I mean, the first time I ever saw a machine that could talk was when I was 12 years old. And that's why I became a computer programmer, because there were machines that could talk, and I could talk to them. And the magic of that was an obsessive thing for me. And I became a compulsive programmer, because it was there. And of course, not every 12-year-old felt that way in 1971. But a few of us did. And we oddly turned out to be the people who half a lifetime later were busy fighting the free software movement and electronic privacy and founding EFF and doing all those other things. A society which wants to change the infrastructure of its technology and which wants to do that for particular social purposes has got to talk to its eighth graders. They're the most important people in the world. And it's true, even a very well-coordinated system of public education, South Korea or Singapore or wherever, will not do that. Actually won't do that. Surprisingly, because of course it knows that those are the kinds of brains it wants to have. But there are cross-cutting considerations, including an absence of teachers who know how to do the work. But that's a secondary. And a distinct unenthusiasm among the platforms, the telecoms, the government listeners, the financial industries, etc., etc. There are very few people who actually want that to occur. But a government that understood itself to be affirmatively responsible for it, in which, for example, its state constitutions contain provisions requiring the state to provide an adequate public education to its children, as, say, New York State does, would have a reason for asking, well, is it an adequate education in the 21st century to teach people how to operate a smart-ass phone, but not how to operate a web server or a mail server or to stand up a Freedom Box? What is it that citizens need to know in order to function well in society, to raise good families, to participate in the community in productive ways, etc., etc.? Questions or observations? A government that has a sufficient interest in the press, in public information, to pass a Newspaper Preservation Act, which says that mergers and acquisitions among newspaper companies are different than mergers and acquisitions among other companies, is obviously capable in its own judgment of legislating to control through influence and thumb on the scales behavior how the press is organized. It's obvious that people believe that government has that power because congresspersons and other parts of the elected government of the United States are constantly going on about what ought to be done to big tech. They obviously think they have the power to govern it, but not an idea about how to solve the problem, only about how to govern the problem. Which is why I am, of course, not interested in European regulatory solutions. And They have no Googles. They have no Facebooks. They have no IT infrastructural industries of their own. So it is easy to talk about regulating other people's. Which is weird because they have just as many 13-year-olds as anybody. Well, not as the Indians, but as everybody else except the Indians. And those 13-year-olds have just as much to gain from learning how to construct freedom, technologies of freedom, as the 13-year-olds in the United States or any other place. But never will that become the story, because Honeywell wouldn't like it. Because the few vestigial parts of the technology industries that are located within the European Union are no more enthusiastic about that than the platform companies are in the United States or the telecom. It's relatively easy, however, to deduce, at least if you're doing it the way I've been doing it here, it's relatively easy to deduce a positive governmental responsibility for making those things happen. Government has decided how the system of broadcasting worked for a century. Government has decided how the press can be structured or what government can do to put a thumb on the scales involving the structuring of the print press, the place where you would think the First Amendment would be the most hostile to regulatory intervention. Government is constantly discussing these days whether it should give Facebook a slap on this wrist or that wrist. If there is any affirmative obligation to do any of those things, then there is an affirmative obligation to do the right thing. As I have suggested here, ad nauseum, I fear, the First Amendment does in fact do that, because it doesn't say that government can't prohibit things, it says that government may not allow things to be abridged. Abridgment is precisely the sort of word which goes to structure. If no law can be made abridging freedom of speech or of the press, then some laws can be made to prevent abridgments of the freedom of speech or of the press. That's not now left-wing doctrine in the United States, that's right-wing doctrine in the United States. That's all those guys shouting about Facebook moderation hurting conservatives all the time. They think there's an equality principle in the First Amendment. They think that principle is being abused by private parties. They want government to redress the inequality. Good for them. Me too. I just don't want to leave Facebook in existence once it's over. But as usual, the problem, as David French was complaining in The Atlantic this week, is that my fellow conservatives have lost the plot on freedom of expression. They want freedom of expression for themselves and not for other people. It's the equality principle that's hard to accept. And indeed it is. Unless, of course, you just read the sentence as written, in which case the equality principle will leap out at you. Nobody's rights can be abridged by law. Which ultimately means that everybody's rights ought to be equal, because if they're not, then somebody's are being abridged. Somebody is shorter than the rest of them. So we can imagine then how a government actually committed to the principles of technological freedom would go about the tasks that it would find itself assigned. And we can understand why those tasks differ from the agenda of presently existing governments in the presently existing so-called West. That is, societies which acknowledge that there are rights of individuals that are involved in these technological decisions, and which believe that the rule of law and an independent system of the rule of law exists to support and cherish those rights, but which stops short of an agenda to achieve that goal through positive lawmaking, either because they are ideologically tender about interference in the free market, or because they're corruptly bought by their own political needs, or because they're overswayed by forms of security theater reasoning on the part of their own internal secret police, or for laziness, or for all of the above, But mostly because there is no political movement among the voters to whom they must respond that identifies this as a serious concern, a greater priority than crime or the economy or terrorism or whatever it is, right? It's a stepchild of the vision of government about what it is that their voters and citizens actually want. And I suppose I would be the first to agree that that's correct. Nobody wants this. That's why I stand here and attempt to explain to people why they might want it. Because otherwise they won't. Other things will seem more important. And meantime, the degradation of human individuality will go on. More about this? Oh no, we're tired of that, Evan. You always say that. Who cares? All right. So, if then we try and imagine what it would mean for government to have such an agenda, and if we accept that there's no political likelihood that that agenda actually will exist or will make itself practicable within the next decade or two, what will happen in the meantime instead? This is why it doesn't make any sense to me to talk about the social credit system in China under its present existing terms. Yeah, it's not a very good system right now, but it will be better later. It will be what the government would do if its agenda were to destroy rather than to build up. It will use private market behavior collection ultimately to decide whether citizens are really good or only partly good or some bad or really bad. And then it will use everything in civil society to discriminate on the basis of that conclusion. Oh, you have the wrong friends? You say the wrong thing? Well, then your mortgage rate will be higher and you won't be able to get train tickets home for the Spring Festival. Just life will become more inconvenient for you in 100,000 ways until you learn not to have the wrong friends and not to say the wrong thing. And then maybe over a decade your social credit score will go back up and we won't be treating you as a bad person anymore. I don't have to explain why I don't think that United States government could adopt such a system without running into some constitutional difficulties like the Equal Protection Clause. But it is important to understand that the spread of opinion among governments in the world will not go smaller on this subject over the next 15 or 20 years as the United States fails to take the position I am suggesting it is constitutionally obliged to take. The world will consist in more and more societies who have either passively or actively and intentionally created IT infrastructure, the purpose of which is to undermine rather than to further those rights. And no government which wants to present itself as the partisan of democracy and freedom as against the autocracies of the world could possibly justify itself. Well, no, I'm wrong, of course. They will all justify themselves. Not on the basis of their performance, but on the basis of their indifference to all of these matters. We'll get around to them sooner or later. So then what would citizens do? Of course, Mr. Zuckerberg's answer has been, well, citizens will form Facebook groups and discuss privacy in my KGB headquarters monitored terrarium. We've been subjected now for more than a decade to propaganda on the subject of how good the platforms are for social mobilization and progressive goals and blah, blah, blah. And part of the reason that, well, that Facebook has to change its name to a word that means dead is that that's dead now. That idea that somehow all of this was really secretly for freedom and better civic engagement and making the world more open and connected is now, on Mr. Zuckerberg's own testimony, dead. The metaverse is in, that's out. Which tells you that there is a political opportunity, right? I mean, when the other guy has suddenly died and fallen over and is calling himself corpse, it would be reasonable to ask, have we a political opportunity here? And the answer is yes, but it doesn't appear to be part of the official political program of anybody. Well, I mean, you know, I wrote the Communist Manifesto in 2003 in order to provide the program, but I knew at the time by calling it the Communist Manifesto, I was hardly seeking to increase public support for it. What then we would find ourselves doing is saying, well, then the state will not educate the 13-year-olds. Should we do it ourselves? I don't have a whole lot of purpose here to advertise Freedom Boxes. Yeah, you can buy them from the Bulgarian manufacturer for $75 US and get them shipped to you and set them up. But what I do have is the proposition that, after all, in societies with rich civil societies, rich in both the material and the depth sense, civil society should be organizing to educate young people, to demand and to run technology that works for benefits, for people, for families, for the small businesses and the neighborhoods from which they come. You know, of course, that there's a missing sector in the American economy that consists of family and small business technical support. The demand for technical support in families and small businesses is very great in the United States, and oddly enough, there's not a sector which serves them. Oh, did you try rebooting it? Well, if you did and it doesn't work, then throw it out and buy another one. Why were those Chromebooks of mine so cheap after the first 5 or 10 that I bought? The remaining 30 were so inexpensive. The remaining 30 were so inexpensive, some of them I bought for $45 a piece, because when you opened the lid of that Chromebook, fresh from the refurb, or you found a new, undamaged model of that Chromebook, the Asus C710 that I was holding up here, the minute you opened the lid, Google told you, oh shit, this is an old device. We won't refresh the Chrome on this device. You need to buy another device. After all, everybody in the technical economy possessing near monopoly power has the classic problem of the monopolist. The classic problem of the monopolist is how to get your old goods off the market. If a monopolist can't sweep his old product out of the market, then he is inevitably competing with himself. His old product will now compete against his new product. The whole purpose of monopoly being to prevent competition, the monopolist will do everything he can to avoid letting his old product continue to exist in the market. He becomes his own competitor. Have I now sufficiently explained for you Windows upgrade policy? When Microsoft had an effective monopoly over PC software in the world, operating system software and many applications, its whole purpose in life was to get its old software off the market and out of everybody's boxes, lest they compete against themselves. This is why one of the shrewdest lawyers in the industry with whom I've worked over the past quarter century said to me once, he was then working for Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft, he said, was never a software company. Microsoft was an upgrade management company. Now consider just for a moment how many different near monopolies compelled to force their old goods off the market contribute to the technology design with which you are familiar. I do not actually use computers that have easily shattered glass fronts on them. Why would I do that? Those easily shattered glass fronts will break, and somebody will charge me a ton of money for replacement glass, and they will try and get me to throw away that object as soon as possible once the glass breaks. It's an upgrade path. So imagine, if you will, just for a moment, the overall cost of useless obsolescence in the IT system. Imagine just for a moment all the stuff that has to be thrown away in order to prevent a party with market power from competing against itself by getting rid of all the old gear. You're aware, of course, that it's got poisonous components in it, that it has batteries that are expensive to process or dispose of, and it winds up in the hands of people who get injured by it. But more than that, right? It establishes a structure of technology usage which is fundamentally wasteful by design. Would we really do this if we had the alternative of not doing this? You're going to watch it happen again, aren't you, as the world moves from gasoline-powered automotive structures to electric-powered automotive structures. Getting rid of the old will be necessary in order to make the energy transition. But once we have done that, and we have made automobiles simple in the mechanical sense, we have gotten rid of all the complexities of the physical parts in the automobile. We have turned them into essentially software. Why will we throw away automobiles ever again? Well, the answer is we will throw away automobiles ever again so that the automobile industry can sell you a new one. So we might begin by asking, what do we desire our children to grow up with in this sense? A mastery of the technology or knowing when it's time to trade it in? After all, I am really arguing that society is overproducing hardware and overproducing small changes to software and underproducing technical knowledge. And that from a social point of view, any society engaged in trying to maximize rights will also try and minimize churn. Because the churn doesn't contribute to rights. And it will try and maximize the degree of technical knowledge distributed throughout society because that is in its long-term interest. This is why in half of the work I do, India is the most important place in the world. Because the combination of a need to educate as many brains as possible and to do so at the lowest possible material cost preconditions the society in the direction of using technology to support, well, something. Rights? That might be going a little far under present political circumstances, but the political economy is still in place. The spread of technical knowledge is the most important part of social development. You don't have to be Nehru to believe that. And the effort to make people equal... Yeah, well. And the effort to make people equal in relation to technology presupposes an effort to make technology accessible, not merely in the sense of avoiding bad social discrimination, but in the sense of objectively flattening it. Social design of technology produces inequality or undermines inequality precisely to the degree that it uses the material substance of the net in an equalizing fashion. Need I point out that the greatest artist of this 20th century, the king of the undead, not dead, was about doing absolutely the opposite? Apple technology was designed to increase inequality, to create a class distinction. It's a cult. But it's not merely a cult, it's a wealthy cult. It's a It's the cult of people who can afford $1,000 laptops and $800 mobile phones. Its purpose is to be the velvet rope outside the nightclub. It was and is disgusting. But that's not the feeling it inspires in the people who love the art. On the contrary, it becomes personal. The technology is for the assertion of social status and coolness and wellness and excellence and wealth. It is, in other words, exactly what a society wouldn't do if it cared. If it were trying to use technology to create freedom and equality, it wouldn't do that, and it wouldn't like that. But the genius of the King of the Undead is that the art is unspeakably beautiful, and it feels good in the hand, which is why I won't touch it. Because it performs the task of bad, which is to make the evil beautiful. And if you think about it, we have many technological structures in our society, not all of them created by Jobs, which make that inequality beautiful. At every level, you could say that that was part of the struggle we were engaged in for the past quarter of a century, or at least until he ran through all the livers society had given. He patented making things beautiful. And then tried to prevent us from making things beautiful because he had a patent on beauty. This was true with respect to typefaces, particularly. Typography was owned by Mr. Jobs in places where it was exceedingly difficult, although eventually in every case we overcame the patents, it was exceedingly difficult to make text look good without stepping on some rake he had put there. What you would really like, of course, is for a society of type designers to come into existence. You would really like young people to be taught that everybody can make text look more beautiful. Instead, I need not point out to you that the amount of textual beauty you're allowed to have is that of Microsoft Word, which is not beautiful. 500,000 years in figuring out how to make a beautiful text, and instead you wound up with Microsoft Word, which doesn't even know about kerning, really. You know, Google went around all of the Indian subcontinent buying up old fonts in all the languages. Hot type fonts. They went around to all the little printing shops from Kerala to Assam, buying fonts in the languages that they would need in the future. We do allow typeface designs to be copyrighted in society, although we shouldn't. What would be the incentive to make beautiful type if people didn't own it? Well, you know the answer to that question. Down to, then to the levels of the technology's relationship to law in detailed ways, you'll find again and again the effort to undermine equality by propertizing, or by making intellectual property, which I hesitate to call property, by creating rules of exclusion. Now, of course, you understand the part of this which I'm not making into an advertisement for the free software movement, which is that that's what we were trying not to have happen to software making in general. To twist the legal rules around so that everybody has a right to make the software, to understand the software, to modify and improve the software, and to share the software with anybody that they want to. The effort is to turn the rules that govern the social creation and distribution of software technology into rules which create equality rather than inequality. There's no software under shrink wrap. There's no set of rules you have to follow, and if you break them, you can't use this software. Microsoft flirted for years and years with licensing on Microsoft Word that prohibited using Microsoft Word to criticize Microsoft Word. And every time they did that, there would be a little bit of an outpouring of outrage, and they would say, oh, we didn't really mean to do that, and they would go back to not doing it. But it was always possibly there. The same way the recording industry in the United States has never affirmatively disclaimed the idea that all recorded music is work for hire and belongs to them. They don't assert it, but they don't deny it either. And that underlying approach to technological ownership rules has the consequence of leaving people in a presumptive position of inequality. But there's no reason why we can't make software in a way that supports equality. We proved that. We changed the entire world software industry in one generation to accept those principles. Government didn't do that. Civil society did that. Primarily young people. And they did it by making stuff and sharing it freely under rules that imposed the free sharing as part of the process of being in the community. Imagine if we do the same thing beyond the software itself. I showed last time how BitTorrent is in effect a system of electronic democracy of that kind. Different software used to share bandwidth in a different way in order to provide for cheaper, faster distribution of culture than the owners of culture can achieve for themselves. If you look in the technical world we have created, you will see repeatedly the institutions that attempt to provide for that form of equality and freedom coming upward from civil society below, not being encouraged from government above. But nothing would prevent a government from doing. Nothing would make it impossible for government to do that. And as I have tried to suggest, at least in the language of my own society's law, something to encourage that, maybe even to require that. The powers that government has are great, nobody doubts it. The shaping effort of government as a purchaser of technology, as a provider of education, as a funder of research, and a thousand other roles. The power of government to shape technology in favorem libertatis is immense. The enthusiasm for doing so, yeah. But you can change that. You will change that. I mean, you will if you get involved. You will if you decide to. Because through the remainder of your lifetime as lawyers, you will be increasingly aware that that won't happen without you. You will see increasingly that government's abilities to shape technology in favor of freedom are great, and its willingness is slight. And this won't depend in particular upon the government and state. There will be some, including what will be then the largest societies, the largest economy and the second largest society on earth, which will be directly committed in the opposite direction. It will not want to use technology in favor of freedom. It will want to use technology to extinguish the very idea of freedom, to prevent the very notion of freedom, which it will have established as a foreign, alien, destructive force. And that will be the most powerful economy on earth. So the question will be, what's to be done? I'm sure that I haven't convinced anybody this afternoon that it's your particular role to solve the problem. But I might have convinced you that the problem is soluble if enough people were to get together and want it to be done no matter what government had to say about it. Which is, after all, how constitutional rights come into existence in first place. They're not given. They're struggled for. That was everybody's experience. That will continue to be everybody's experience. And each little bit of new technological capacity that you acquire, and even more than that, each new piece of technological capacity that you having acquired teach, the more that's exactly what's happening. may not be enough, may not be fast enough, may not be complete enough, but everything you learn how to do that you teach somebody else how to do is that process occurring. So I'll start posting exercises. Office hours are now if you want to talk to me. Otherwise, thank you for riding the extremely dangerous New York City subways to come to class. I'm very grateful to you. See you in a week. Thank you.